I defy you. Seriously, I absolutely defy you to name me a smarter business person in this economy than Beyonce. Oh, also, steel trade and housing on the program today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In New York City today, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, the 17th of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Two possibly slash probably interrelated items with which to begin on this Wednesday. Item the first, we learned this morning that the Chinese economy grew 6.4% in the first quarter. That's from a year earlier. And for those not keeping score at home, that is more growth than a whole lot of people expected. Item number two from the Wall Street Journal, there is talk that there might be some kind of U.S.-China trade deal signing ceremony come late May or early June, which gets us to the synthesis part of this program. How does news item one, a recovering Chinese economy, fit into news item two, Chinese trade talks? Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson gets us going.
The question is, where is China's economic recovery coming from? And the answer is, mostly, it's government. Nick Consonieri is a China researcher at the Rhodium Group.
The biggest economic policy story for China over the past 3 years has been this deleveraging effort that the government pursued to reduce debt.
China had been trying to tamp down on lending to boost its financial stability. But as growth slowed last year, its priorities shifted. To boost growth, it's now encouraging lending,
particularly to Chinese corporates. So what was previously a stifling effect has now become a driver of growth again.
Corporate borrowing has shot up to a six-year high, according to data from the China Beige Book, which tracks the country's economy by surveying thousands of Chinese companies. Shahzad Kazeh is its managing director.
This is almost entirely a credit-driven or a credit-soaked recovery. What you see is that anybody who wanted a loan in Q1 got one, and that is really what has propelled this Q1 recovery.
The Trump administration had previously argued that China's weakening economy would motivate Beijing to close a trade deal. So the question now is whether that leverage goes away with its current economic rebound. Kazeh doesn't think so. He says China still wants an agreement. Ishwar Prasad, trade policy professor at Cornell, agrees.
The U.S. still has some leverage over China because China clearly wants a deal.
But Prasad cautions the U.S. doesn't have a huge advantage in these negotiations either. The White House also wants a deal.
U.S. financial markets also seem to have been boosted by the prospects of a U.S.-China trade deal. So I think it could have a negative effect on both financial markets and economic activity in both countries if a deal is not struck.
Prasad says the question continues to be what that deal looks like and how comprehensive it might be. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Okay, Tracy, having done the synthesis, we now move to practical application, as in what does all of this, American trade policy circa mid-spring 2019, what does it mean for people out there actually running businesses? For that, we have gone to one of our go-tos. Lisa Goldenberg is the president of the Delaware Steel Company of Pennsylvania. Lisa, it's good to talk to you again.
Great to speak with you, Kai.
Let me give you the first and usual Lisa Goldenberg question. How's business? How's steel these days?
I would give it a fair. Disappointing is a better way of saying I'm not down in the dumps because I rarely get that, but I'm just, things are not humming along as they should be. This should be a pretty busy time of year, and
yeah.
I'm disappointed to say that things are not as robust as expected.
How come? What's going on?
You know, it's tough. I gave a very strong first quarter forecast, and I completely blew it. I'm humbled to say. I guess that happens from time to time. All the indicators gave us reason to believe first quarter is always strong, and this would be equally strong, and it just wasn't. I think manufacturing volume's a little bit down, and I also think that margins are really getting squeezed.
Huh.
It's difficult to say why. Chaos fatigue. I think the world is chaotic.
Yeah, that's where I was going to go. I was going to ask you to quantify uncertainty, right? Because here we are a year into the Trump administration's trade program, tariffs, and people are still sussing it out. We don't know what's going on with China. How big a deal is uncertainty, or as you just called it, chaos fatigue?
Well, I think it's a continuum. Where you first start, when there's chaos, it's exciting. And people scramble to buy or to take positions because it could get really bad, right? So if I told you that drought was coming, you'd run and buy water. But if after a year drought wasn't coming, you wouldn't buy that much water. And after a while, you'd start to think, what about the water I have? And I better start drinking that. And do I need more? And at the same time, the administration saying we're going to have a deal any minute. So not only is drought not coming, but in fact, you might have an endless supply of water. So how much water would you go buy? So it's the same thing with steel. And the fatigue is nobody knows how to plan. Everyone's numbers are just, it's dramatically off. So something has to change.
I'm going to ask you a personal question here. You ready?
Go for it. I'm pretty open.
I know you are. That's why I feel okay asking this question. how long have you been in the steel business?
1987.
So without putting any of those, this is unprecedented and oh my goodness, it's cataclysmic. Is this one of the most unusual periods you've seen in your industry?
No. Huh. In that sense, that's a fair question. We've been in horrible steel markets, you know, scary downward spiral, no end in sight. This is not that. This is something entirely different. I speak to people all day who think the administration is doing a great job. They just want policy. And I got to tell you, in manufacturing, there's a lot. They just got unbelievable tax credits. So it's been a huge boost to manufacturing. And people who really dislike the, you know, administration, they're saying, well, okay, I don't like you, but give me some policy so I can make a plan.
How much is this chaos slowing you down? And I'm talking just simply dealing with paperwork and all the tariff exclusion requests and all of that stuff that comes along with this.
Okay, it's so burdensome. So I have been waiting for months for steel to cross the border from Mexico to the United States. And the answer I'm given day after day is you'll just have to wait your turn. It's really, there is no proper way to handle the paperwork. So steel sits. I got a call of a very good Canadian customer screaming the other day that paperwork was taking forever to cross the border and blaming my team. And we worked with Canadians, you know, for 200 years, sort of effortlessly. This is a new drama. Suddenly we're combative with our trade partners. It's bizarre. It's craziness.
Lisa Goldenberg, she is the president of the Delaware Steel Company of Pennsylvania. Lisa, thanks so much. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much. Happy spring. It's gonna improve.
Down the southern end of this island today on a lovely spring day, it has to be said. Traders were mostly blah. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The cavalcade of tech companies going public in this economy continues tomorrow. Pinterest, the social pinning company, I guess, is the quick description. It starts trading. Also, the video conferencing platform Zoom, both of them valued in the billions of dollars. But unlike many of its recent unicorn brethren, Zoom is actually profitable as the demand for video meetings continues to grow, which has in turn resulted in it being a somewhat crowded space. You got the biggies, WebEx, GoToMeeting, and Skype, also a handful of smaller companies. And as Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino explains, technology like this is changing, obviously, the way we work and also the way we live and maybe even how we do our hair.
Gone are the days of the crackly speakerphone piping in unintelligible disembodied voices. In many workplaces today, meetings sound more like this.
You are in the meeting now.
Hi, can you hear me?
Although the tech is not without hiccups.
Hold on. Hi, can you hear me now?
Omar Zaki is an old pro at troubleshooting in moments like these. As a product manager at a software company with teams spread around the globe, he works full-time out of his home office in Atlanta, where he takes video calls like this all day.
I think that it allows a certain amount of inclusion with people who aren't there. Using video in addition to the audio side of the conferencing really helped me build my personal brand so that people know who I am. They put a face with the name. They don't just hear the voice. They don't just see the name on the call.
That visual recognition is key, says Catalina Toma, a digital communications professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We also chatted by video.
Nonverbal cues could be successfully used for getting people's attention and engagement. and can facilitate a feeling of closeness and liking and trust, actually.
That fosters better collaboration and puts remote employees on a more even playing field with their peers in the office. Gallup polls show remote work is increasing in the U.S. More than 40% of workers surveyed skip the office at least part of the time. That can have big benefits for employers, like attracting talent that could be based anywhere and saving money on travel. For employees, it can improve productivity and quality of life. No commute, no distractions, time to pick up the kids from school or even catch a wave.
I spent a month in my favorite surf spot, surfing 4 hours a day and putting in a full day of work.
Sarah Schott is a nonprofit consultant who loves to travel. She's based in Seattle. I caught her on video chat during a long weekend in British Columbia. And she sometimes spends weeks working remotely from a Caribbean island where she meets with clients over video.
I was, very quickly switching from surfer girl look, putting my hair back in a neat bun, touching up my makeup. Because you're only visible from, like, here up, right?
But not everyone is so camera savvy, says Carol Kinsey-Goman, a corporate communication coach who did not want a video chat with me.
I'm in my ponytail and my gym clothes, and I thought, that's just not really the way I want to be seen.
Because she knows how important optics can be. She once coached an executive who conducted an entire video meeting while looking down at his desk.
And literally what people saw was the top of his bald head while he was reading these notes instead of actually looking at people.
Video conference etiquette can vary place to place. Kids or pets walking in, probably okay. Eating your lunch, maybe not. But whether you're presenting well on camera or not, Goman says there's still no substitute for in-person eye contact. Even if you manage not to stare self-consciously at that little image of yourself on screen, which you know you do, camera position makes it tough to keep a natural gaze, it's difficult to read the room, and you're missing out on those spontaneous connections that happen in the hallway between meetings that feed relationships and creativity.
In a 40th of a second, you can create a bond with someone simply by shaking their hand.
And that's something no amount of technology can replicate.
Goodbye.
I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Neiman Marcus, they of the over-the-top Christmas catalogs and high-end excesses, is trying something new. The company's getting into the second-hand business. It's just made an investment in an online luxury accessories reseller called Fashionphile, because, to use the technical term, the market for used stuff is booming. Last year, consumers spent $6 billion on second-hand luxury items, a market that in just 4 years is expected to grow to $23 billion. So as Marketplace's Erica Barris reports, Neiman wants in, and it wants in now.
Neiman Marcus? Buying back used Burberry and Gucci handbags? Well, half of the retailer's customers are already reselling, says Jeff Gallick, marketing professor at Carnegie Mellon.
If their customers are doing it anyway and they're not making money, why not get a little piece of it?
Environmentally conscious consumers are a big reason why the used market is growing. Trini Ahmed is with Yale Center for Customer Insights.
They're interested in sustainable fashion and reducing the carbon footprint, and I think this secondhand clothing trend really satisfies that need.
Then there's that social media pressure to look fresh.
Holidays, events, meals, everything, didn't really happen if it's not on Instagram or on Facebook. And so with that, I think is this huge increased need to, not be seen in the same clothes.
Plus, nice things are more accessible when they sell for 30 to 90% off retail.
It just feels good.
Katie Campbell, a 26-year-old in Phoenix, Arizona, has gotten into buying secondhand designer shoes.
I grew up in a kind of a low-income family. We didn't splurge on things like this, and for good reason. But I also grew up kind of reading Vogue and daydreaming about these things.
But top-shelf brands may not be happy about this, says Mark Cohen, director of retail studies at Columbia University. Discounts undercut the perception of these brands. Chanel, for example, sued secondhand site The RealReal, which also tried a partnership with Neiman's.
Some luxury brands might be so put off by this that they see fit to just pull the plug.
Neiman's will buy back items like purses and belts in its stores for cash. Whoever wants to buy that used purse or belt will have to go on Fashionphile's site. Neiman's is hoping customers who come in to sell used stuff will take their cash and buy a new purse. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
At marketplace.org right now, pre-owned versus used. A brief disquisition. Check it out. Coming up.
You know, I'll take voodoo at this point if it will sell this house.
What selling a childhood home might say about the housing market today. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials barely changed today, 26,449. The NASDAQ down 4 points. That's less than a 10%, 79.96. The S&P 500 shed 6 points, about 0.2%, 2,900 on the nose. Morgan Stanley up 2.6% today. Bank of New York Mellon down about 9.5%. Biggest fall since 2015, by the by. PepsiCo bubbled up 3.7% today. The soda and snack firm beat analyst expectations. Coca-Cola increased 0.7%. United Airlines rose 4.7%. Today, American Airlines about 1%. Southwest down just a tad. Bond prices unchanged. Yield on the 10-year T-note, 2.59%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There is a slice of the audience listening to this program right now that might be struggling a little bit today, might be a little bit distracted, because last night, smack in the middle of the night, smack in the middle of the work week, the entertainment and economic powerhouse that is Beyoncé released her documentary Homecoming on Netflix. It chronicles what you can only call her epic performance at Coachella last year, an homage to historically black colleges and universities, HBCUs they're called. The concert was also released as a live album last night, and Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has been listening to it all day long.
Let's go! The drum lines, the choreographed step teams, it sounds like a real HBCU event. Except when you add Beyoncé to the mix, it's a homecoming frenzy. Sirona Elton is a music business professor at the University of Miami.
You know, my 12-year-old niece is going to talk about this, and my 70-year-old mom is going to talk about this.
And that buzz will push people online to Netflix, iTunes, Spotify, and Tidal. And through these partnerships, says Elton, Beyoncé's business savvy pays off.
She's created a powerful entertainment empire and made sure that she is going to be the main beneficiary of the revenue generated.
Forbes estimates Beyoncé is worth more than $350 million, and that was before her latest tour. And she has a history of setting trends in the music industry. For example, more artists are now doing visual albums, like Janelle Monáe and Childish Gambino. Hopefully, other artists won't pick up on late-night album drops in the middle of the work week. No apologies, because when you're Beyoncé, says Soraya Nadia McDonald, culture critic at The Undefeated, it doesn't matter when you release your music, or film, or whatever.
People will find a way to watch it as soon as it's available, regardless of if they have work in the morning, or a crying baby, or whatever.
And Beyoncé knows it.
Change the game when that digital drop, I stop the world.
And for the Beehive, it has. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Of all the financial decisions that life brings us, few, if any, are as emotionally loaded as buying and especially selling a house. A house or a condo or an apartment, it's not just a place we live, right? It's where lives happen. And that is why when Marketplace's Amy Scott saw that her childhood home in Colorado Springs was not only for sale, but that there was an open house coming up, well, you knew she had to, right? Here's Amy.
I still dream about the house I grew up in. It was a big blue Victorian with white trim and a red door. Out back, there was a deck and a concrete slab where I rode big wheels with my older brother and let him destroy me at basketball. I hadn't been inside since junior high. Now, here I was 30 years later, walking up the front steps with my husband and my own two kids.
Oh, wait, let's eat your pretzels not in the house.
My old blue house is taupe now, with white and purple trim. The Victorian-era mechanical doorbell my dad put in was still there.
Yeah, it doesn't quite work anymore.
When we went inside, I half expected our old furniture to be there, too. The black Naugahyde couches and swirly black and white curtains, the wall-to-wall gold carpet. But the house was empty, and the floors were gleaming hard wood that apparently required protection.
Oh, do you want us to wear booties?
If you wouldn't mind, the owner would be very appreciative.
Sure. Yeah.
A lot was the same, though. The French doors my parents closed when they watched TV at night. The broken drawer in the butler's pantry. I climbed the creaky stairs to my old room, took a deep breath, and opened the closet door.
It's still here. Come here.
Down near the bottom of the door frame, where I hoped my mom wouldn't see them, were my initials.
AES 74 to 89. Of all things, that's going to make me cry.
I'd carved them into the wood with a ballpoint pen the day we moved out. My mom was getting remarried and we needed a bigger place. I was 14, kind of a crappy age even when your world isn't blowing up. I didn't want to leave. My mom still lives in the neighborhood, so after the open house, I went over. We pulled out the old photos and kept the nostalgia going.
Oh, yeah, so that's the fireplace
and the white walls.
Look at that
and
perm.
And here is the kitchen
mom,
wallpaper.
Look at that perm.
It was my perm. I looked like a mushroom. My parents bought that house, their first, in 1971 for $19,500. My dad was a new college professor, making $5,000 a year. My mom worked part-time for the Girl Scouts.
I can only remember one other house that we were kind of serious about, but it would have been a stretch because it was in the 20s. But in retrospect, I think we got the best house for us that we could afford.
$19,500. In today's dollars, that would still only be around $122,000. But my hometown is booming, and my parents' starter home was now listed for well over $500,000.
It makes me kind of sad that I don't even think Alex and I could afford that house. You know, that would be a real stretch for us.
And we're not just starting out. Nor are we alone. Houses almost everywhere seem to have more earning power than most of us do. And buyers are running out of stretch, which may be one reason my old house wasn't selling. I went back to talk to the seller to find out what was going on.
Hi. Hello.
Molly Cassidy and her dog Oni greeted me at the door. Molly's in her early 60s. She wore a cowboy hat and hiking boots. She bought the house in 2000 for $262,000. That'd be about $387,000 today.
Did that seem like a lot at the time?
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
However, when I started seeing the market go up, I thought, well, it's probably been a good investment.
Over the years, she poured herself into that house. She filled it with antiques, mixed her own paint colors, and stained the walls in her bedroom with red Zinger tea.
It was a labor of love, which is why a lot of people can't appreciate it, I don't think, because it's not their love.
Today's buyers want the charm of an old house, but the amenities of a new one. They want a master suite, not the bathroom down the hall.
It has stymied me. I had no clue that it would take this long to sell this house.
She's knocked the price down several times to $559. She's also buried a figurine of St. Joseph, believed to help sell homes faster, in the front yard.
You know, I'll take voodoo at this point if it will sell this house.
Before I go, I ask her about the memorial I left in my closet.
Did it ever occur to you to cover it up?
No, never. You know, it's all just part of the character of the house.
And whoever buys this house, I hope they feel the same way, too. I'll be back to check. In Colorado Springs, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
We've got some pictures of Amy's old house. Also, that mushroom perm, which I guess you got to check out. It's on our website, marketplace.org. Final note on the way out today, two of them, actually, both macroeconomically inclined. First of all, Herman Cain says he is not going anywhere. Mr. Cain, floated by the president as a nominee to the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors, has run into both personal and professional, that is, economic policy resistance from GOP senators and others. The president's top economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, said yesterday the White House is looking at other potential names. Mr. Cain told the Wall Street Journal today he is still in it to win it. Also, the Beige Book is out, the Federal Reserve's 8 times a year regional and anecdotal analysis of this economy. Here's my favorite from today's report. Manufacturers are worried about Chinese tariffs, the report said. One small home builder in the Philadelphia region went so far as to stockpile a 3-year supply of nails in anticipation of rising costs. Kind of gets back to what Lisa Goldenberg was saying up at the top of the program, doesn't it? All right, we got to go. The Dow Industrial's flat today. The NASDAQ down 4 points. That's less than 0.1%. The S&P 500 down 6 points. That is 0.2%. Our media production team includes Sarah Begare, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Holliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.